sundown, shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
Found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Well, and welcome to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Kamau. Ricky on the board. SP Futures down 29. NASDAQ Futures down 150. Do we have Professor Carl?
You do.
How are you, buddy?
Well, you know, I have a question for you.
Uh-oh.
So, you know, I know you like to bag on the Orange Cheeto, and I do from time to time as well. But, you know, yesterday was Drinko de Mayo. Not Cinco de Mayo, Drinko de Mayo. It was, you know, the 5th, right? I take the 5th. I consume the 5th.
There you go.
So, yesterday, out of Mr. Trump's office, come 2 executive orders. And
gee, well, I can't imagine him pontificating in front of the camera, signing stuff like he's Caesar.
But you know, it is just because... See, now, you prejudged him, you don't even know what they are yet.
Doesn't even know he has a Congress that he's supposed to be doing this stuff with?
This, by the way, is not necessarily... Well, okay, he has a Congress he's supposed to be doing something with. How many of them went to Epstein's Island?
How many of who? Congressman or him?
Congressman.
I don't know. If they track...
Okay, how many of them are in APAC's back pocket?
Well, let's put it this way. If we track down the thing I sent you with all the cell phones and stuff that went there, we probably could figure out, but nobody's going to figure that out.
Oh, no, hell, you can't, you know, gee, that hasn't been released, even though we were promised it, right?
Remember? I did. The only thing I do like that makes me proud of Chicago is not one of them is from Chicago.
Well,
few in Detroit, few in L.A.
Yeah, right, fair point. So, anyway, here they are. The first one, I'll just give you the titles and I'll tell you what they are. Improving the safety and security of biological research slams the door on gain-of-function stuff.
Which is the thing that he reversed when he came in after Obama.
Yes, he did. By the way, Barack Obama was the one who originally slammed the door.
Yeah.
However, Barack Obama only sort of slammed the door. Okay? And he left the loopholes that when Trump came in were then accelerated and greatly advanced and led to the mess.
So I don't know if you ever designed a railroad car, when somebody does what Obama did and cut off one path and you still got to get to where you want to go, which those guys wanted to fund it, Fauci et al.
Right.
Becomes it. The term is it's a workaround.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
So that's how they had to enlist Europe and North Carolina and those places to get them the money?
Yeah, it was. Essentially, they scammed their way around the rule. Okay.
How did North Carolina never get spanked for this?
Well,
let me ask you this, though. And I don't think you know, but maybe you might, because you know.
I probably do.
The decision made at North Carolina.
Right.
Was that a board level decision, or was that somebody that the people in charge never even knew what happened?
Well, now, Okay, board of who?
Well, I mean, the people, the board of regents, whoever runs a state university.
Right, because this was a university.
Yeah.
Well, so here's the basic problem that you run into with this sort of thing, which is that I'm sure at the department head level, they were well aware of what they were doing. Were the regents aware of it?
I mean, I guess reason why forgive me on this. It's my own self. All these places have, at least they should have, some level of expenditure that people can do along every level, and over like $100,000 or something, it probably needs to be a board call. Was this over that much, and did the board say yes, or do they keep it 99.999 so they didn't have to see it, I guess, my question.
Well, this is what audits are for, and of course, nobody wants to do one, right? Because then what you end up doing is you end up in a very uncomfortable place where you should be laying mass manslaughter charges on everybody involved, right? Because of what happened, obviously, right? No, we don't want to go there. Good God, we might have to put some people in jail, like forever, never get out. You know, we'll let your bones out after you've rotted off your flesh has rotted off the bones. So that's the first one is to and actually if you read it, it is comprehensive enough, and has enough reporting in it that if worked around or violated. It is an instant 5-year ban from all federal funds with regards to biological and pharmaceutical research.
But now there's some kink here. Is because the money came from Europe through North Carolina, wasn't really ours? Or I'm dancing around here just for the listeners, real quick, Carl. I know you know this. Every organization, and, you know, maybe not PTI because my brother and I, but every organization, like even at Pullman, like. The controller, if I went to Boston for a meeting with the people in the Boston car, and the trip was, you know, $2,000 or something, that most would airfare and everything else, the controller, my boss, could sign for that. If all of a sudden 15 guys were going for a weekend to learn about, you know, some new way of doing accounting, and it was going to cost $15,000, probably the VP of finance would have to sign off on it. It works its way up the chain. And at that time, probably it was $50,000 the board would have to know about, or at least the vice president of Pullman Inc. There's a way to work your... Every organization of that size has levels like that. They still do, I think, Carl. So at some number, at the University of North Carolina, somebody had a sign for this, whatever they were doing. And I have to believe, unless they chopped it up some way or used it as part of a grant, you know, I don't know... If they get grant money from Europe and they spend the grant money, whether that's a pass-through or what, I'd love to find out, Carl.
There's all sorts of, you know, EcoHealth was the nexus of all of this. And the guy who is in charge of that has, even as recently as a few months ago, still running his mouth. Okay, and where he ought to be running is, you know, to the prison yard. But, you know. It is what it is, and that we have nobody in this country who's willing to go boil up some tar and play tar and feather with guys like this is just shocking to me. But, you know, there you are. I mean, especially considering the results, all right? I mean, you know, the argument is always, well, we have to get this, we have to do this because, you know, something natural will happen that will be horrible and we have to be prepared for it.
By the way, you're almost clairvoyant in my next question. If it did go to the board, and some schlump like me who doesn't know anything about this, assuming I never met you when I was on the air,
right.
I didn't know anything about it, what does the presentation to me look like?
That's always how they present this, is that, you know, we have had, you know, we had 1913 happen, right? The swine flu.
Yep.
That came home with the GIs, all right, which is how it got in the U.S., and you know, wars are a serious pain in the ass when it comes to, you know, any kind of infectious agent, because there's a whole ton of people in very crappy conditions.
Oh yeah,
and so, you know, I mean, that's, well,
was it measles one of the biggest killers in the Civil War?
Oh, yeah.
And yet, if you're 10 years old and your mother keeps you warm and feeds you for the week, you never die from it.
Well, one of the biggest problems, well, not never, but rarely.
Yeah.
On the other hand, in crappy conditions, it gets you with a decent, you know, decent degree, right?
Yep.
The other thing is that the camps during World War II, largely work camps. So, you know, they were trying to kill, you know, all the Jews. Well, okay, maybe they were, maybe they weren't. But what they did have a problem with was typhus. And typhus is carried by lice. So anytime you had people...
Oh, I thought typhus was water. It's lice? Wow, okay.
No, it's lice. So the problem, of course, is lice is an endemic thing, right? I mean, you know, these days, you know, kids, you know, every now and then, you know, if you got a kid in school, the kid comes home and, hey, guess what, right? But the thing is that they carry lice, and so, you know, they carry typhus. And so the problem is that you have a train come in with, you know, buttholes to elbows,
oh, yeah,
packed full of people. If those people get into the camp with lice and they're carrying typhus and they don't know it, 2 weeks later, half the camp dies. All right. So, I mean, it's bad. But this is the kind of thing that happens during wartime, right? Is that it's a fairly common problem because, you know, the dudes are, you know, hanging out in trenches or, you know, in a shower for 3 weeks.
Colonel, I just had my nephew's daughter's first communion at Sarah's talking about yesterday, the same place I had mine. And in those days, everybody lived, in fact, one of the houses, I showed it to Audrey, I go, you see that? It's the Harrigan house. And she goes, yeah, what's so remarkable about that? I said, well, look at it. There were 10 kids in there.
Yeah.
And I don't know. There were 42 kids in every class. I don't know one person that ever had lice. And I don't know one person who died from measles or chicken pox or mumps. Was it the community care that much better or what? I mean, you didn't...
No, so measles has always been one or two in 1,000 with reasonable sanitation.
And the German measles were actually considered more dangerous.
So rubella...
Well, that's what I mean. Rubella had attacked, like, got if an adult got it when she was pregnant, you were in deep trouble, those kinds of things.
Well, right. So the biggest issue with rubella is that if you get it as a woman when you're pregnant, it's very likely to kill the kid.
Yeah.
Okay. It probably won't kill you, but it will kill the child with very high degrees.
Well, that's pretty bad.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, that's the reason that it was, you know, that is the argument for, you know, for taking a vaccination against it, is that if you're not immune...
Well, a regular measles vaccine does not cover rubella, does it?
No, it's a combination shot now. It's okay. MMR. It's got mumps and rubella in it as well. So anyway, that's number one. The second one is intended to force back into the United States the production of pharmaceuticals. And it does this by a number of mechanisms. One of the most important ones is something we should have been doing all along. If you are a pharmaceutical manufacturer in the United States, you're making the precursor chemicals, you're making the drugs, you're actually making you're making the stuff here. Just as is the case, by the way, with meat packing plants, you are subject to surprise inspections. No notice, FDA guy shows up, and they go through your plant, and they look for, you know, an extra cockroach or two in your equipment.
Yeah.
All right. Well, guess what? They don't do that overseas. Okay? So, you know, how good is the quality over there?
Well, that's what I've been fishing around with every other guest, Carl, including you. And I sent about the stuff about the Smoot-Hawley tariffs and all that stuff.
Right.
I think there's a lot of stuff that you've brought up and other people have, mostly you, and a lot of, you know, and I was a child of Dr. Friedman, and I'm curious as to how some of this has gone awry. Because in his day, when he had to look at things, I think those guys were fairly accurate. This is the way we should have proceeded, but there's things you have to watch for along the way that basically we didn't watch for.
Well, it's not that, Chief. It's not that we didn't watch them. Everybody.
Well, some people were making money, so we didn't pay attention to it.
Now you're getting.
I'm trying to be nice here this morning, for God's sake. You're not letting me. You know, just.
I think we should shiv everybody who has it coming.
What I'm saying is that the question is, we have to figure out a way to do this. And I also, when you mention that. I know, you know, a lot of people that are on various drugs. When I say drugs, prescription drugs. Right. And a lot of them, especially some of the, what's the one you take for your thyroid, a lot of the thyroid medications and so forth and stuff. I mean, I, you know, I just know people and, you know, at my age, a lot of people are on stuff. And a lot of people say the generics don't work anywhere near as, what is the deal with that? Or they're saying that they get on the generic and it doesn't work and the doctor says, oh no, let me put you on the one that's made here. How could if they're supposedly the same thing, aren't we even inspecting that?
Well, this is the gist of the problem, okay? Is that the you know, we supposedly, I mean, if you look at the FDA, the FDA essentially put a stop to snake oil salesmen, right? Because I mean, that's,
I don't know why, they're mostly all alcohol.
Well, it was one of the first things they did, okay, was they started going around saying, well, you know, there wasn't actually any snake oil in there. By the way, mislabeling is a crime. You know, here, slam.
They could have just put Makes You Feel Good on there and you'd be all right.
Well, then they would have been okay, but they said it had snake oil in it. It didn't actually have snake oil in it. So mislabeling is a really serious issue, and it is, and it ought to be. And that was one of the first things. But the entire, you know, there used to be a culture of you got to prove it not only is what it says it is accurately, okay, not kind of, sort of, but it really is, no contaminants, and that the percentages are correct and everything, you know, the actual chemical is what it's supposed to be. There's no adulterants in it, things like this. But you also have to prove that it both works and it's safe. And if you can't do those things, then it doesn't get licensed, it doesn't get in. And that,
well,
used to be...
Sort of. There are drugs that make it without ever doing anything, and they look around for a disease for them.
Well,
if you're big enough.
I understand that, okay? But back when the FDA actually was not in the back pocket of pharmaceutical companies and there wasn't a revolving door and it wasn't wink, wink, nod, nod, by the way, we don't have to prove that we're better, faster, cheaper. We just have to be better than a sugar pill. Okay, which is crazy, because if there's already something for a condition, you ought to have to be better than that, faster than that, or cheaper than that, fewer adverse effects, or you shouldn't be able to get licensed.
More expensive, that's what you want in there.
Well, that's right. Now the key thing is, as long as it's on patent, we can charge whatever we want for it, therefore more expensive is the key.
The ones that are off patent, they're no good. We got to get one back and
got to get one that is, right. And there's myriad examples, including the situation with the asthma rescue inhalers, which was people should have been beheaded for that. All right, I'll go that far with that, because that was ridiculous, and it was a false environmental claim that was used in order to support it. But back when the FDA actually did its job, the reason we did not have tens of thousands of thalidomide babies, and Europe did, is that one woman at the FDA took a look at the data and put a hard stop on that drug being sold in the U.S. to pregnant women.
And now that woman would have been ostracized or something.
Well, and now we would claim that the kid that has, you know, 3-inch long arms was you know, she was obviously using drugs, something other than the pharmaceutical.
Yeah.
She was, you know, she was injecting herself with it. Yeah, it certainly wasn't the, you know, the drug that her doctor prescribed that did that. That Trump, you know, yesterday, I mean, surprisingly enough, yesterday these two things hit, and I read through both of them, and I couldn't find a single word in either of them that I disagree with. Now, the key here.
Use Obama's from the one he reversed?
No. No, he didn't. He went way further. It's going to be virtually impossible to get around this one. So the game playing that went on when Obama was in office...
Somebody who wants to has already figured it out.
Well, we'll see about that, because the, you know...
I hope not. I mean...
Well, I hope not too, but you know, I mean, here we are, right? Now, you know, getting him to admit that the platform that he advocated for and ended up being used is wildly defective and by the way, needs to be banned,
That's we got a long way to go to get there, right? Because then he has to admit that he screwed the pooch and, you know, and harmed a huge number of people by doing it. So, you know, we'll see. But forward steps are still forward steps.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the problem that we have, though, is that as you've seen and as we repeatedly see, if you actually want to drive change, you have to have something that survives beyond the next election. All right, because otherwise, if I'm an industrialist, I'm a business person. I mean, you know, I could worry.
Why isn't this? I mean, Andrew was on last Thursday, Andrew Craig, and he said the difference between Roosevelt and Trump is Roosevelt managed to get these things passed. Why can't he get this passed as a law?
Well, primarily because this isn't the time of Roosevelt. This is the time when every single The only thing that matters to anybody in Congress, the only thing, and this is the reason I left Florida, okay? Florida has a terrible problem and has had a brewing problem. Of course, as you know now, it's all over the news with homeowners insurance and insurance generally, okay? The reason that has happened is fraud. You have building codes that were greatly strengthened after Andrew, which was in the 1990s.
Yeah.
All right. And oh, by the way, they didn't really need to be strengthened. But what was discovered is, you know, you put up some structure and it's supposed to meet a set of structural standards. You find out whether or not it really did when there's a hurricane.
Yeah, well, that's the truth.
All right. Well, all right. And all the people who cheated are exposed because their roof's in the middle of the street, all right, instead of on their house where it belongs. And or worse, their roof is in the next door neighbor's house and destroys the neighbor's property, all right? So this kind of thing was exposed by Andrew. The codes were strengthened, da-da-da. But nobody goes to jail. And so I saw repeated instances of this where houses that were built after the Andrew codes were there, hurricane comes, roof's in the middle of the road, the house was built after the code changes, and you can see that the straps, the secondary barrier, all the stuff that's supposed to be there isn't there. It's missing. All right, now once the thing's torn off the house and is sitting in the middle of the street, you can see whether or not the appropriate things were done, right? But, so, how is it that the guys who built the place don't go to prison for this? Because what they all do is they all set these things up as separate LLCs. Oh, gee, the LLC's gone. Bye. All right.
Well, the corporation is one of those things that it's on the list of the 10 smartest things men ever did. It's also on the list of the 10 dumbest things men ever lived.
Well, the 10 most evil things when abused,
yeah.
Right? But the thing is that fraud vitiates everything, and in both state and federal code, I mean, you know,
that never happens unless somebody's after you.
Well, but I've talked about this, you know, 15 U.S.C. and 8 U.S.C., you know, 15 U.S.C. chapter 1, 8 U.S.C. 1324. These laws carry felony criminal penalties, go to prison penalties, not get fined, go to prison. And yet in the state of Florida, they did absolutely none of this. And as a result, the insurance company can't tag you as a homeowner because you're not the one who did it. All right. So they can't deny the claim. They'll lose if they try that.
This may be more of a thing for Friday, because I got to ask you a couple of questions. Yesterday morning, was that the bottom in the oil, 55.50?
You know, I don't know. And
right, backstory here for those who weren't listening. Oil was down $2 yesterday morning when we started doing the show, and then it came back. It was only down 70 cents, but it's trading up $1.27 today to $58.40, which is still low. But right. Yesterday morning, I think it hit a bottom of $55.50 and bounced off there. Is it?
No, I would not bet. All right, so technically, maybe, you know, on a technical level or whatever have you. But here's the thing that I think is interesting is that in the, you know, oil has always been an extremely cyclical business. The people that are down doing the sands, you know, the fracking stuff and the sand stuff down in Texas and, you know, in other areas, nobody's making money at this price, okay? And
I thought that the new techniques had gotten their break even down to like upper 40s, but I'm not positive on that.
You got to look at the servicing costs on the debt too, though.
Yeah, well, I mean, you got to look at everything. I get it.
Right. I'm saying all in. I don't think anybody's making money. At
well, there's
bucks.
there's no two spots that are alike. They all have different basis risks.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, I mean, and it varies from well to well, right? I mean, you know.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. If you're 3 miles from the pipeline or railroad, it's different than if you're 20 miles. I mean, everyone's different.
Oh, absolutely. But the thing is that when you get down to it, there's, you know, we're in a world, and then you have, you know, the OPEC plus guys that have said, despite the fact that prices are down here, we're going to increase output, which, you know, I mean, we gave these guys, the cartel, a literal cartel, exemption from antitrust when the oil shocks happened in the 1970s. That was actually
you know what the quid pro quo is? Then we got to go to break. You know what the quid pro quo was?
On that?
Yeah, and on OPEC. And I think this was a Bush and gang deal. We let them, well, it wasn't like we could have broke the hotel thing anyway, but if we could have, as long as they used their extra money to buy U.S. treasuries, it was okay.
Right.
And oh, by the way,
well, that
if,
was
if
the
you look at a list
dollar.
Of if you, look, yeah, if you look at a list of people that buy the treasuries, you'll never, they are off book. You'll never see Saudi Arabia, like, listed as one of the
well,
buyers.
You'll never see it as actually in the list.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I know. And I, you know.
Yeah, is right. Hey, hang on in case Kenny doesn't call in. I think he will. But Joel, I think, is with us. SP Futures down 45. NASDAQ Futures down 214. Hey, you know, Carl, did you ever take any options education up in Chicago when you were here?
No, but I did an awful lot of reading and taught myself how to trade them and how they work.
We just heard some nasty news this morning that Alex Jacobson died. Remember that name?
Yeah.
Alex was the lead instructor at the Options Institute for years and years, one of the nicest men I've ever come across, and incredibly intelligent when it comes to this stuff, and he used to help out at our seminars all the time, and one of the most honest guys, just a real honest dude. And I got an email from a listener today saying Alex had passed, and boy, it's really bumming me out. I really liked him.
Well, that sucks.
Yeah, that really sucks. I'm going to try and find out. I don't even know how old he was, but I'm thinking he might have been a little older than me, but I'm not sure. But boy, what a nice guy. And he was the face of option education for three decades.
Yeah.
And all trying to make people trade better and safer for their stuff. Nothing. It was all just education, and if you want a protection or whatever, I learned a lot from the dude. I mean, just amazing stuff. Anyway, SP Futures down 43, NASDAQ Futures down 204. What do you think, Carl? We had 10 days in a row up. Now we've got two down. What's the story?
Well, we're sitting technically, again, it has nothing to do with fundamentals. Technically, we're sitting right at a level that should reject if we're headed lower in the S&Ps.
All right. Well, if we don't talk today, we'll sure talk a bunch on Friday. Like I say, we'll be right back, Stacks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Loan on Bank Stocks and Jocks. I'm tomorrow. Ricky on the board. SP Futures down 45 now. We're leaking a little bit. NASDAQ Futures down 210. That's over 1%. A lot of stuff happening here this morning. Individual stocks in the Dow, nothing crazy. McDonald's down $1.84. NVIDIA down $1.58. We've got Apple. Where the hell's Apple? Apple's down $1.05, under 200 again, 197.84 after bouncing back over 200. Over in Europe, now these guys have been strong. Today, not so much. DAX down 177.8%. FTSE down 5, call that flat. CAC around down 31.4. So down early a little bit. Asia, let's see, we've got still no trade in Nikkei. The last was 5.2. Hang Seng, let's see. That they are trading. They're up 158.7%. And it looks like we've got the Shanghai up, trading for the first time in a while, up 37, minus 1 point, or positive 1.1%. So rally there after being closed for several days. Bonds, 10-year unchanged, 4.34. They were up, the rates were up yesterday. Bund up 1 basis point, 2.53. We've got oil, which again bottomed out at 58.50. It's up $1.19 today to 58.32, so somewhat of a bounce off the low. Brent up $1.22, 61.45. Natural gas up 4 cents, 3.59. Arbob up 2 cents, 2.04. Gold, after a huge run up yesterday, is up another $70 today, 33.92. That's up 2%. Silver up 80 cents. It's up 2.5%, 33.28. We actually got even a little longer gold yesterday, so it should be a good day. Yesterday we had a real good day. FX, the foreign exchange, euro. Again, at 113, so the dollar is under a little bit of pressure. Now we've got the trade deals coming up. We've also got the Fed meeting this week. British pound, 133, pretty much unchanged. We've got crypto down 690, 93,844, but it's still pretty darn high. Yesterday, as a way of review, Dow was down 98, S&P down 36, NASDAQ down 133. So we're down more today than we were yesterday, at least in the futures. Ricky, what do you have for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Morning, Chief. It's currently 7:36 a.m. here in beautiful Chicago. We're looking at 47 degrees right now with a high of 71. Warm, mostly cloudy morning today, and then we'll be seeing some sun in the afternoon. Tonight will be partly cloudy with a low of 55 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 63 degrees right now with a high of 74. Shower this morning, times of clouds and sun this afternoon. And finally, a couple of showers late tonight with a low of 60 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, Iman Edens from Lane Cook. We're looking at 32 minutes, 34 minutes. Iman Eisenhower from Wolf, Iman Dan Ryan from 95th, 19 minutes, Iman Stevenson from 24 to the Dan Ryan, 30 minutes. MLB, yesterday the White Sox lose to the Royals 3-0, Cubs beat Giants 9-2, and then the Diamondbacks lose to the Mets 4-5. Today we got a rematch of all three of these games. White Sox at Royals 6:40 p.m., Giants at Cubs 6:40 p.m., and Mets at Diamondbacks 8:40 p.m. Let's go to the NBA. Yesterday the Knicks beat the Celtics 108-105, and the Nuggets beat the Thunder 121-119. Today we have Pacers at Cavaliers 6 p.m. and Warriors at Timberwolves 8:30 p.m. Lastly, NHL, Maple Leafs beat Panthers 5-4, and today we got Hurricanes versus Capitals at 6 p.m. and Oilers at Golden Knights at 8:30 p.m. Back over to you guys.
We have Joel?
Yes, we do.
Yeah, good morning.
How are you, bud?
I'm doing. I could not be doing any better.
Well, that's a good thing. What does that mean? You couldn't be doing any better. You could have won the lottery or something.
I don't know. I'm just in a good mood today. I don't know. I don't know why.
You're long oil. You're short the market. And you're long gold.
And people interested in my exciting long term portfolios. I'm long cash. A lot of cash. I don't know. I'm not as good as stock pickers as everyone on Twitter.
Everybody's because they only tell you they're winners.
No, I think, man, what a great point in the market we're at. I don't know if you missed the break and sold in the hole or bought the dip and you're rich now. I just think that, you know, we've come back to a level, you know, we're not that far off. I like to name different days, and I call these the high that we made on Friday, the post-liberation day high, right? Because we hit a little bit higher in the S&P on that day, and the market's just settling in. So if you didn't buy the dip, you didn't buy the dip. If you're more prone to selling rips and you were puking all over the desk when the S&P was under 5,000, I think you have to take a look at your holdings, your portfolio, your asset allocation, and say, hey, what do I want to do for the rest of the year? What do I want to do for the rest of 5 years? What do I want to do in 10 years? I think it's a great point to do that. And I think sometimes the other media get caught up so much on the day-to-day fluctuations and everything that, you know, you just got to sit down and look at the big picture. And I think this is a good time. The market's calmer. The VIX is lower. I mean, I'm not saying throw on puts, throw on hedges. I'm just saying look at your asset allocation and see if you can sleep at night.
Well, that's what I find, Joel. And I, Well, I deal a lot with individual people, and not very many of them have a portfolio that matches where they should be in risk and age. The last 15, 20 years has most people way more risky because nobody's in fixed income because it didn't pay anything for a while. Mm-hmm. You have people that are 85 years old that are all in high volatility mutual funds because that's where the money's been. And you're not going to do the idea that you're going to say change the bucket here. It's a horrible, it's just not a message anybody wants to hear. So the way I try and get around that is to do some kind of protection on it. And at least then, if we rack it down, maybe we can make a little money on the protection. We can buy a little of the dip and sell on the top because we're constantly rolling the protection. Not constantly. I mean, there's been years we never had to roll it. But now when we're talking 1% and 2% moves every day or two, you end up doing more. You end up being almost a trader on your protection, which is not the way it's designed. But it actually works out well if that happens.
You don't have to be that right either.
No, it's amazing when all of a sudden you say you buy a stock at 100, and you buy the 98 puts for protection, say. All of a sudden the stock rockets down to 90, and you go, ew. But maybe now you can sell these puts out for a profit, and you buy the 90 puts for protection because you're not going to buy the 98 puts. They're $8 the money. Now, granted, if the stock keeps going down, that's probably not the right move because every time you do that, you put a little more premium on the table. But if it turns right around, comes right back up, all of a sudden you look like a genius because you essentially got a little longer at 90 because you rolled the puts. But it also might not work. It might actually go to zero. In which case, I mean, you'd rather not roll them. So every time you do a trade, there's something good that can happen for it and something not. Of course, you listen to people on TV, they got it all figured out. Nothing's easier if you want a stock at 100 and it trades 80 and then it's back to 95 or 100 saying, well, I knew it all along. Bull crap. Nobody knew it all along.
Chief, I got a question for you. The one that I struggle with my co-portfolio manager, my wife Lisa. As far as selling stocks, legacy stocks, that you've had in your portfolio for a very long time, and I wouldn't say that they're outsized, maybe a little bit too big. What do you say to people that say, I can't sell because of the tax implications?
If I had a dime for everybody who didn't make the right trade because of tax implications, I'd be the richest man on earth.
Okay.
It definitely is something. Matter of fact, we deal with that all the time. I had a client who worked for UPS, and she passed a while ago. And actually, I can say this: the person who had power of attorney on the account was her brother, and the basis on the UPS stock was like $2. So yeah, you got to be real careful if you wanted to sell that because she was very gravely ill, and because of the tax law, when she died, she was able to pass that stock on to
the cost basis.
The cost basis. So you had to be real careful not to sell that stock. You didn't want to either cover right. You had to make sure if you were assigned, you delivered short stock and bought that back. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that a real firm can do for you. That if you're doing it on your own, mm-hmm. you don't know any of these tricks, but. They're not tricks. There were ways to manage your portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's very, very difficult when a stock is a legacy stock. Plus, but if somebody's 50, one guy came in once. These are all true stories. One guy comes in and he goes, he's like 10,000 shares of Exxon. I don't forget what it was at the time. It was a lot of dough. And I said, well, what are you doing with Exxon? Well, my dad worked for Exxon and gave me a stock. I said, okay. He goes, well, I can't sell it. Well, why not? I said, it was like $1 million. I said, if I gave you $1 million today in cash, would you tell me, don't hesitate, go buy $1 million worth of Exxon stock? He goes, well, hell no. I said, okay. You just answered your own question. He said, well, my dad had it. I said, your dad's not here. And by the way, if he was here, what if I asked him the same question? he'd probably say sell it. Okay, then. You know, what you do, you end up, what you try and end up doing, Joel, you're trying to act almost like a doctor, where you ask the questions and let people give you their own answers.
One thing I want to say on this is the problem is, okay, is that what happens is, and I can give you a true life example, is the stock goes down. And then you say, well, I can't sell now.
Oh, yeah, so, without a doubt. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, but, hey, I got to hop here, Chief. Great chat. I think today is, important. I would just really, I'd like to speak more to longer term investors out here, you know, on this show. You know, keep an eye on that price action from Friday. You know, keep an eye on your closing prices from Friday, because I don't think we haven't come to a resolution on tariffs. I think earnings season has been pretty good, pretty bad. I mean, depends what you own. But, you know, we've had a nice run off that low. So, you know, bulls make money, bears make money, and pigs get slaughtered. So, you know, take a look to see where you're at.
Joel, I think what you're saying is you're looking to make money. You're not looking for vindication here.
Right. That's a great way to end it. Okay,
all right, buddy. I'll talk to you next week, and we'll get our other stuff together.
We got a double duty next Tuesday. Yes. I'll keep you in the loop. I won't mess it up this time.
All right, buddy. Do we have Kenny?
Yes, we do.
We do.
Hey, Kenny, how are you, buddy?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine. I understand you were the big buyer at 55.50 on the oil futures.
Yeah, I don't know who keeps whispering all those things in your ears, but no, I was not the big buyer. I wish I was, but I wasn't.
Yeah, hey, did you? I got a nasty memo this morning that Alex Jacobson died. Did you hear that?
Who?
Alex Jacobson of the Options Institute instructor for 20 years.
No, I didn't hear that.
I cannot find it anywhere in the thing here, but I have to assume if somebody sent it to me that it's true.
Yeah. Well, if it happened this morning, maybe they just haven't picked it up yet.
Yeah. Yeah. What a nice man, huh? I don't know if you ever listened to any of his stuff, but
I never did.
But he was the face of the options education for 20 years, for God's sake.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I hear you. You know, and I it's funny because all those years I spent on the New York Stock Exchange, you know, I was just trading stocks. I wasn't trading options. I couldn't trade options on the floor, and so it wasn't an area that I spent a lot of time in. So no, I didn't. I wasn't listening to him.
Because I mean, he was always out there. Because all the at one point, I'll just be real brief on this. The Options Institute was an educational arm, I think, that was designed by the CBOE. Russell knows all this because he worked for them for a while. I'll talk to him tomorrow. But they were an educational arm of the industry, and then after a period of time, you know, the CBOE said, well, you got five options exchanges, we should all participate in this. And even though the guys were pretty much here, everybody shared. So even New York had an options exchange for a while, so those guys would go out and teach anybody that the New York Options Exchange set them up to teach. So it was really people learning about what I consider to be a fantastic product. I mean, I know a lot of people say, oh, geez, options are risky or whatever. I can't think, Kenny, of any strategy of somebody thinks about in a stock, it's going to go from here to there in this period of time. But I can't think of any strategy that I can't do better and less risky using options than just plain stock.
Right.
You know, right. which isn't to say somebody shouldn't own stock. I'm not saying that. But if you were to say, I think IBM's going to go from 100 to 120 this year. Well, okay, we're going to buy the 100-120 spread. Why the hell are we going to buy the stock? The stock's $100. We got $100 worth of risk to make 20. What are we doing with that?
Right.
You know. So I mean, just how I was trained, and Alex was very, very good at that, and he talked about it at a level where every man understood what was going on, if you wanted to pay attention, which is, you don't find that anymore. Nobody wants any education. They just want, you know, whatever. They want the tip or something. Now, you're the guy. Who called you to tell you to buy that stuff 55.50 at 6 o'clock in the morning the other day? I didn't even know what traded down that low. I was trading 57 when I came in. I thought that was low enough. What do you make of that? I know we don't usually talk about futures and stuff, but this kind of happening, these things happening around the market, obviously make a difference in the market, right?
I mean, well, they do. But you know, listen, the nervousness that is now enveloping the markets this week is once again out of the chatter that comes out of the White House. While the market tries to repair the damage suffered over the last month, right now, every time Trump opens his mouth and talks about tariffs or talks about another threat or talks about ongoing conversations, until there's a definitive deal or until the headlines really start to lean more positive, the market's going to continue to react the way it reacted. So, you know, trading lower does not surprise me at all. We've been talking about that. That it's got to thrash around for a while until it feels comfortable with or more certain about where we're going, where these conversations are going. And right now, they're not. Yesterday, he throws out tariffs on the film industry of 100%. Today, he's talking about tariffs on Big Pharma that he's going to announce next week. And so it continues to be these negative headlines, which will cause the algos and the traders and investors to shoot first and ask questions later. So they're going to hit the sell button, and then they're going to hold their cash. They're going to wait, which is okay if you want to do that. But for the long term investors, that selling, as we've seen, will cause some really, really high quality names to become dislocated, therefore creating a long term advantage for the investor. Now, whether you play that using options, like you just said on IBM, if you think IBM's going, you know, up $40, you're going to play the option spread versus owning the stock. But if you already own the stock, for a while, and that's how you play it, then you know you're going to buy more of it.
Well, if you own the stock and you protect it, it's the same position, right?
If you own it, you're protected. It's the same position, correct?
It's so interesting, Kenny. When I do a seminar, well, I haven't done it in a while, but this is after the '87 crash and people got clobbered on puts and so forth. I would say, what is the safest position you can use with options? And immediately five hands would go up and they'd say the covered right.
Right.
Which means you already own the stock and you sell covered calls against it. And then I would say, what's the most risky position you can own? And somebody would say, naked put. And I'd say, that's very interesting. It's the exact same position. Isn't it?
Yeah.
But the difference is, you've already said, I'm comfortable with the risk on the stock, so you don't think of it the same way. It's all about how you perceive it.
Right, that's right. It's all the perception.
Yeah, The thing that really is bugging me, Kenny, and I don't want to get into too much of the politics here, but the thing that's bugging me, we've talked about on the show, and you've got better stuff to do than listening, but there are things that have gone, I'll say, awry in the free trade policy. It has to do with some, maybe not inspections on drugs, maybe it has to do with child labor, maybe it has to do with offshoring pollution. There's things that haven't worked out as the Milton Friedmanites in the world planned, not because they were wrong in their theory, but because, you know, communist institutions and places have somehow intercepted the laws of economics for at least a while, like a long while, right? So yeah. Things have not worked out exactly. I mean, we really don't want to be buying stuff. Well, I guess if you don't have any money or you don't care, you don't mind buying blue jeans made put together by 14-year-olds if they're cheaper. But by and large, most of us don't really want to see that happen, right?
No, so, you don't want to.
So now the question is, how do we deal with that? And, you know, we have a president who, for some ridiculous reason, I don't think he has the mental capacity to go through all the detail on this, and his response is this shotgun approach or this sledgehammer approach of tariffs, plus in the back of his mind he's convinced every time there's a trade deficit we're getting screwed, which is absolutely not true. But now you just mentioned he could blurt out today 100% tariffs on pharmaceuticals. Okay. Right. So somebody is bringing penicillin in from India at $2 a shot.
Yeah.
Right now it's $4 a shot. And a hospital here charges you $100 a shot. What has he accomplished? If we're worried about the penicillin plant not being inspected, you haven't solved any of those problems. If we're worried about the people over there in the plant, they're 8 years old and they're working. I know that's an exaggeration. He hasn't solved any of those problems. He hasn't solved anything other than throw some... And depending on where the markup is, you haven't even solved the price problem.
Right. I understand that. But I think in terms of... I'm in this camp. In terms of, like, medicines and pharmaceuticals, I think it's a national security risk to trust the production of our medicines that you and I take to be produced in third world countries like India or emerging markets.
You can't find a guy who agrees with you more. I'm just saying the tariff is a horse bleep solution.
Well, okay, or maybe the tariffs are going to get Big Pharma to say, okay, we're going to bring the manufacturing to the United States, and then if they do...
No, they won't. If the advantage is so great, no inspections of plants, 14-year-old people doing it, if the advantages are that good and we're bringing it in at $2, they're still not going to make it here at $10.
Well, you know, that's interesting, because I was just watching, and I missed it because I dialed into you, but Maria Bartiromo on Fox was just interviewing somebody from Eli Lilly, and they were talking about this new plant that they're building to do exactly that. And I missed the story because I was dialing into you, so I want to go back and listen to it.
Yeah,
but it was the Eli Lilly representative that was actually talking exactly about this issue and about how Eli Lilly is now, you know, building a plant to manufacture a bunch of these pharmaceuticals here in the United States. That's not going to happen tomorrow, and it might be 2 years out, but the fact is they are doing it. So I don't know, and the story just came out. She just interviewed
I'm going to say that if they are doing it, it's 80% for reasons other than tariffs, which, by the way, I agree with. I'm hoping they do build a plant here.
Yep.
And I'm saying...
Well, it might be.
Yeah.
The tariff is just another kick in the butt, right, to do it.
Somehow or another, we've got... Tariffs are generally a horrible idea. Just are. I mean...
I'm not suggesting that tariffs are great and you should do them all the time, but I do think that, you know, if it's used strategically, and let's see, because it hasn't been proven yet, right? We still have no trade deals. They told us, you know, 2 weeks ago, we're right on the cusp with India and we're right on the cusp with China. I mean, Japan, we haven't gotten anything, which is why the market is now starting to get a little unsettled as well, because... It needs a base hit. We need one or two base hits. You don't need a home run, but you need a couple of base hits that say, okay, we have a deal with Japan. We have a deal.
What do you mean by a deal? A lot of people, in my opinion, are letting these people define the argument.
Okay, well, yeah, there has to be a letter of understanding, a memorandum of understanding between the two countries on what this trade deal is going to look like. The trade deal itself is not going to be, you know, written in stone by the end of the week, for sure.
Well, one thing is for sure, is you're paying taxes and so am I. Why does nobody mention that?
Why does nobody mention what?
The fact that today, the regressive tax bill of people in this country is going to the moon.
Yeah.
That's the issue. Whether China ever comes here and kisses his ass or not, the fact is today people are collecting tariffs from countries that didn't do anything to us, and best guess what, you and I are paying them.
Yes, on some of that stuff, but I think, right, because then you can make choices on other stuff not to just buy it. If it goes up in price, I mean, unless it's a necessity, but if it's a discretionary item, you can choose not to buy it.
If everybody in this country only bought what they absolutely needed, the economy would go to hell.
Say it again?
If everybody in this country only bought what they absolutely needed, the economy would go to hell in a minute.
No, agreed. But you can decide, just like you can when inflation hits, people to make different choices, right? They buy chicken instead of steak when prices go up, or they buy, you know, they buy pasta instead of meat when prices go up. They do make choices along the way when prices go up. Now, that doesn't mean everybody's going to make that choice. But the fact is, I do think that tariffs, while I'm not a big proponent of them ongoing, I do think that, and it's yet to be seen, but I do think that they will accomplish the goal and cause these companies to renegotiate, right? And that's
what makes you think?
You want them fairer in the year 2025 versus when they were written back in the 9th and the 20th century.
What makes you think that that's even the goal, Kenny?
What makes you think that that's even the goal?
Just because the orange man says that. What makes you think the goal isn't to drop $600 billion of regressive tax on people so we can lower tax on corporations and rich people?
Well, is he going to lower taxes on corporations?
He's going to pass. They're going to extend the tax credit.
Extend the tax, right? Which flowed to everybody. Everybody saw that tax rates decline under his original plan, right?
Very few. The increase of the the credit, everybody gets the deductor, the standard deduction. With the inflation that's gone up and dropped everybody of median income, they used to be under 40,000 to over 40,000. I think you're down on the deal.
Okay, that's true, but the inflation that happened under the Biden administration...
Trump-Biden administration. Most of the money supply increase went up under Trump. not Biden.
Okay. The money supply may have increased under Trump, not Biden. But who created? When did inflation hit? Inflation didn't.
Inflation always is about a 6 to 8 month lag, which according to our CPI idiots, it's been that way since 1975.
Right. So your argument is that Trump ignited the.
Yes. That's a fact. I think it's a fact.
Ignited the fuse, and that the results just hit during the Biden administration.
Well, I guess what I'm saying, Kenny, is it's all about controlling. I won't say the media. I guess we're media, right? Well, you are. Yeah. I'm not. Is controlling the media. If they are correct in their estimate, by the way, I think they're not. I don't think it's going to be near as bad as they think. The estimates are $600 billion in tariff collections.
Yeah.
If regular people control the narrative and not people who are afraid of this guy, when is the last time, you're not going to be able to answer this because I don't think that, when's the last time somebody put through a $600 billion tax without going through Congress? It's never happened.
No, yeah, you're right. Now, listen, I hear you, and I'm not suggesting that I want this to go on, but I am in the camp that I do think, and look, I'll be the first one to say if it doesn't work, I was wrong, I misunderstood it, whatever, but I do think that in the end, you know, it's going to be, it's ugly or it feels uncomfortable right now, but I think in the end it will be a benefit. Okay. I think it will be a positive.
So
I think
I'm absolutely stunned that really, when the more I look at it, the more incredibly astonished I am, Kenny, is we're letting somebody drop a tax of this magnitude on our people, with the idea that foreign people are going to come somehow kiss his ass and come some kind of a deal, and are they going to go down? I don't think so.
Well, that's the argument, right? I think they're going to go down. Yeah. I think the trade agreements are going to get renegotiated and they'll be more favorable.
And tariffs will be back to $60 billion a year instead of $660.
Well, that's yet to be seen, right? So we'll just see how this unfolds.
I think you and I will make an adult beverage bet on that, and I'm gonna book it already as a win.
All right, I'll see you out in Chicago for that bet. I'll take you up on that bet.
That in 2 years, okay, here's the bet. Last year, tariffs were $667 billion.
Yep.
This year, they're estimated to be $667, and we're now 2025. So let's give it a year. Let's assume you and I are hale and healthy.
Right.
The bet is you win if they're under $67 billion in the year 2027. I win if they're over. I think I got a winner.
Yeah, I think you have a winner too. But
it doesn't matter. You can buy the first round. I'll buy the second round.
I need to come out to Chicago and buy you a drink.
That's okay. I'd love it. By the way, you sound great.
Yeah. No, I feel good.
Good for you.
No, I feel good.
Good for you, buddy. Hey, talk at you next week. Always fun. And by the way, I hope. I do think we have issues with some of these countries. I wish we could sit together and find a way. I'd much rather inspect the damn plant than make the thing coming in $2 instead of $1. What's the difference?
Okay, that's fine. I wish we could do that too, but at the moment we can't, apparently, for whatever reason. And the fact is that, you know, when you talk about how it's made over there, you know, the child labor laws and all that stuff is unnerving to some people, as it should be. So a lot of those things need to be corrected, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, but it's who's got the money? They're the ones. They're the ones, you know, padding the pockets in Washington.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
Now, if you and I had $1 billion, we could go shove stuff in the other pocket. We'd be just as good, or just as bad.
Yeah, I hear you.
take care of yourself.
I see you.
S&P futures down 43. Nasdaq futures down 205. Do we have the professor?
Yes, we do.
Professor, hey, how are you? How are you? What'd you think of all that?
Oh, it made me sweat. I got a workout. You guys are sparring pretty good.
Well, you know, Kenny's a brilliant guy. I mean,
Oh yeah, definitely. I enjoy watching him on Maria's show.
But you know well, he's much better to watch because he has so many gestures. He's a gesture guy.
Yeah.
true to his Italian heritage, he loves his gestures. I grew up in a kind of an Irish neighborhood, so I don't know. I'm half Italian. I never did the gesture thing, but. He's a terrific dude. But it is when you say we're jousting, there's so many levels to this that whatever argument you have, you almost forget about another level, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's I'm astonished, you know, is that everybody, we have a constitution that says all revenue bills originate in the House. We've got a guy who decides he's going to drop by some emergency war act or something that he all of a sudden has the right to drop a $600 billion tax increase on people, and nobody talks about the tax increase. All they talk about is how he's gonna kick ass on these Chinese guys. What as you go to the store every time you buy something, now you're paying more. I mean, how do you blow that by people?
Well, you know, the Office of the Presidency is, you know, pretty powerful. They can write an executive order, and the Democrats, if the president is Republican and he signs an executive order, and the Democrats don't control either house of Congress, there's really nothing they can do until the next election.
Does that equal a dictator?
Well, I mean, that's executive authority.
Nobody did that.
When the next president comes.
Go ahead.
When the next president is elected into office, that president can reverse all these executive orders. Well, that right there is a Keynesian issue, right?
Is that any way to govern?
Well, it's not. No, it's not.
Isn't that what we had?
But both sides use the pen, and this one's using it a lot. I mean, he's using it a lot, but there's nothing really the Democrats can do until the midterms, right?
Why?
They can make their argument.
Does anybody? That's what we have Congress for. I mean, this thing. Look what's happened.
If you look at Jefferson bought the Louisiana Purchase on an executive order. So this is not new power.
That's because he didn't pay very much for it.
Yeah. Yeah, but he didn't use... I mean, he railed against
But the check, he couldn't write the check. Congress had to write the check. Right?
But he signed an executive order, and he...
Yeah, but I mean, they must have at least approved the expenditure. They had to. Because he can't write the check.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if Congress voted for it, but I do know that Thomas Jefferson signed an executive order, and presidents have used the pen a lot. So I mean, what the Democrats can do is they can make the argument next year.
Well, yeah, but I understand that. But when Roosevelt came in, he got legislation passed. Like even this thing, we were talking about with Carl about it's a perfect example of how screwed up this is. Is Obama passed or did an executive order regarding this gain of function thing? You know, he's banning the gain of function because the people. Quick story here: somebody came to the NSA or something, wasn't it, Hale, and wanted the U.S. to fund this gain of function research in China. And the NSA, this is the dumbest thing anybody's ever come across, and said no. So Fauci and gang, I don't know how hopped the chain he was, decided to do something else. And somehow or another, Obama signed an executive order banning gain-of-function research. Which means, gain-of-function means that you essentially, under the excuse of trying to get ahead of new biological viruses and so forth, you get ahead of them themselves with stuff that'll kill them or something along those lines, right? Which means you're essentially experimenting in the same kind of crap that you don't want to have happen. Is that essentially the layman's description?
Well, you're trying to get a patented vaccine established before the so-called pandemic occurs.
You almost have to create the pandemic so you can create the vaccine, which is incredibly dangerous,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, yeah.
So anyway, Obama signed something. I might have been a sloppy one. He signed something banning that. Trump comes into office and I think
the ban was within the boundaries of the United States. Actually did it over in the Wuhan lab. In the Ukraine.
Right, but what ended up somehow or another, the money came from Europe, and our people went through the University of North Carolina, was somehow involved and got the money over to Wuhan. Now, I'm not saying Obama's...
Well, I think the scientists left UNC and went to Wuhan. That's kind of what
I think some money went through there, too. Anyway, but the point was Obama signed an executive order banning it. It obviously wasn't as good, maybe, as the one Trump signed today. But the minute Trump comes in, in his zeal to you know, reverse every executive order. I'm sure. I'm not sure. I'm going to say the guy didn't even read it. He reversed Obama's executive order. Now, whether it would have happened anyway or was already happened to anybody, who knows? But now all of a sudden there was no. The thing goes over to Wuhan. The thing escapes from the lab. How many zillion people die? I mean, that's what happened, right? And so now Trump evidently today, and I think Kevin tweeted in or messaged me that this one's actually very comprehensive and probably is the work of Bobby Kennedy, would be my Kevin's guess, and he's probably right. So now today, but now my point is, this thing is so obviously needed. We're talking about a guy. Why can't you run that through Congress? Why? That should be a law, for God's sake. Not an executive.
Well, you know,
order.
If you look at Congress, though, it seems like Congress they act like they want power, but I don't think they do, because you look at the way they pass these bills. They pass bills that just kind of give the administrative state blank checks. And they kind of want, I think they want to offload the political risk. They want somebody else to take the fall. So they just write these blank checks to the administrative state.
Right. So now, right now today, if you took a vote of young people,
I think they've willingly given up their legislative power.
Okay, so all right.
Because who really runs the government?
Are you happy with the dictator?
I don't think Congress runs.
Are you happy with the dictator?
I'm not. No, I'm not.
Okay, so
I'm not happy with Congress. I'm not happy that Congress has given up its authority. I mean, if you really look at it, the last 50 years, Congress has just kind of like gone along. They just keep increasing these federal budgets. They give the cost of living increase. They don't really know what's going on with the money they're appropriating. They don't even know what's in the bills. They will tell you.
All right, so
we won't know
so,
it's in the
okay.
bill until we pass
now,
the
now, until they, quote, straighten out, it's okay to have a dictator.
Yeah. I don't think they're ever going to straighten out, because I think they like the way it is.
Right,
they,
so
can,
right, okay.
they can preen on TV. They can act like they hate each other. But when on the crucial stuff like the Stock Act, what do? They work in tandem together, right? They rode the Stock Act a year
all
after
right,
it was signed into
all
law.
Right, so if we're not going to
have...
Okay, my question continues to be, if we're not going to have a Congress, what do we got left?
I know, but on the day of the Boston Marathon bombing, President Obama signed the scaled back, the toothless version of the Stock Act. On the day of the Boston Marathon bombing, what does it tell you? And this was a voice vote. It was a voice vote, and it was 80-20. And there weren't 80 Democrats in the Senate. There weren't 80 Republicans in the Senate. I mean, this is just a problem with government in general. The Congress has given its authority to the administrative state, and they just write checks and they just go along with it. I don't know if Congress is all that interested in codifying these DOGE cuts. I mean, the administration seems really amped by these DOGE cuts, but I don't know.
I happen to think that there's a chance here, because I have a feeling. Nobody's getting more abusive phone calls right now than Republican representatives, where people feel they're getting hosed by the current administration that didn't vote for this at all. Some of the stuff that's happening.
Well, I mean, I think he's getting a little... He's going overboard. I mean, this whole thing with the tariff on independent movies made without outside the United States, I mean, you know, I was kind of hoping that a 10% was his goal, just a 10% broad tariff on all imported goods. I think that is doable, but why is it doable?
It's a tax increase.
Well, but you know, we got to make sure that, I mean, what a Democrat personally, I don't want any of it, right? I don't want any taxes at the federal level. I think government should be at the county level, and then maybe a little bit at the state level, and then as little government function as possible at the federal level. I'm an originalist on this.
All right, so a 10% across the board tariff is the single biggest tax increase you've ever had in this country.
Yeah.
You're happy
well,
with that?
My point is that if this all this effort levels these playing fields, and I've looked at the Swiss situation. They do have a VAT. I think it's an 8% or 20% VAT. They don't have tariffs on industrial goods, but they do have substantial tariffs on agricultural goods, and I understand why they would, because American food is pretty poisonous. I mean, they have like RFK Jr. says that, you know,
they don't have tariffs. They have restrictions on stuff that has.
Well, they have tariffs on biologicals and food. They have if it's GMO or something.
Yeah,
like
that's what I'm saying. They have restrictions more than tariffs.
Essentially, you can't export it into Switzerland, right?
Okay.
Biologicals and food, which I understand because, you know, our food compared to European food is a lot less pure. So I understand that. But they do have a VAT. You have to pay the VAT. So the VAT acts as a tariff.
But we have to pay sales tax.
No, they don't have to pay sales tax.
We do here.
Sales tax is imposed at the state level.
It's
only on retail goods. It's only at the retail level.
Okay, but everybody ends up having to. I mean, when they import something in here, somebody here has to pay sales tax on it, same as a value added tax.
Well, it's not the same as a value added tax because it's at the retail level. It's not on anything on intermediate goods. So if you're importing intermediate goods, there's no sales tax because sales tax is only imposed on final goods and services.
Yeah, which
the
means
cash
you and me we end up paying on everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
But all I'm saying is if it results in all countries lowering the trade barriers and we end up with a 10% tariff, I think that is pragmatic. And I think it'll fair things up. Because, I mean, come on, Tom.
Why would it fair things up? I mean, so everybody else... You are probably the most pure research person that's on the show. Why would you believe anything these people say?
Well, I think actually Bessert, if you listen to Bessert and Howard Lutnitz.
Oh god.
If you listen to those two guys.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah. I think those guys are the ones that are pushing this. I think Trump wants to go all out on tariffs, but I think they're kind of reining them in. And if they can get 10% and all these restrictions eliminated, if there are any restrictions, I think that's good.
What do you mean? We have restrictions and stuff coming here.
I know.
We're not pure here.
I mean, I want our restrictions reduced too. Like
no, that's
sugar.
Not going to happen. We're not going to lower the sugar tariff or the sugar import quotas. We're not going to lower the timber import quotas. We're not going to lower the dairy stuff. We're not going to lower any
Tom,
of that.
What has been going on for 50 years in the United States, you and I know this, the middle class has been hollowed out. What we've been doing isn't working. Something has to change. There has to be a disruption to change that. Because the United States, if you're in the financial industry, you don't understand what's going on. You think everything's great. But when you get onto Main Street and Elm Street, in these communities that have been hollowed out, by the fact that, I mean, if you listen to this guy, Luke Gorman, he's really got a fascinating take on the trade deficit. What he says is the international trade has been set up in a way that makes Wall Street the bankers of the world. It makes, it kind of...
Without a doubt.
And it pushes U.S. treasuries, right? So it's a way we finance our deficits. And what happens is when we have a trade deficit, we have this capital surplus. And what people do is they take the gains in trade, and what we're doing is we're buying consumer goods that end up in landfills. That's what we do. We buy cheap goods that end up in landfills that aren't made by people in America. They're made by people outside the United States. And what do these other countries end up with? They end up with cash. And what do they do with this cash? They're actually buying hard assets. And so I don't think this system is working. And it's not working because of all the central planning that's been going on. Decisions are made in New York and D.C. that benefit the small group of people, the small group of puppet masters. And it's hollowing out the United States. I'm doing research on enterprise zones. And what we find in enterprise zones like in New York State, for example, it's a 0% income tax for the owner of the company and some of the employees, provided the incomes are below $200,000. Where if you move or you start your company in one of these startup New York campuses, which are on the campuses of SUNY and CUNY, if you move your operation, or you start your operation in one of these SUNY campuses or CUNY campuses, start up New York campuses, then you get free tax-free income.
Let's think about that. I understand where you're going with this. You have people that have offshored stuff.
To benefit
from child labor and other things. And oh, by the way, they've paid off the politicians in those places to make sure that the child labor stays the way it is. It's a horrible situation. But if you look at the people that you are talking about, people like the people you and I know, the lower class, the middle class, since their wages have gone absolutely nowhere in the last, relatively nowhere, in the last 25 years, for as long as I've been on the air, I've said the last thing that you can do to these people, if you really want to eviscerate them, in the words of Milton Friedman, inflation is the cruelest tax there is.
Oh, it is, yeah.
And so now, in the last 5-6 years, the last 20 years, because we've lied about it, we've had this inflation that's been over people's income, which really is what has eviscerated the middle class. And now I don't understand how I can possibly have anybody debate against me that a tariff is a tax. It's a very regressive tax. I never even dreamed that we would try and put a tariff on these. I would rather have somebody say, if you don't have child labor laws, there's a ban on everything from your place. I'd rather do that than have a tariff against people here pay.
But another goal of this whole policy is to encourage manufacturing come back to the United States.
Maybe.
Right. Maybe. That's the encouragement.
None of us know the goal these people have. All I know is they're putting a tax on people.
Yeah.
That's the stated goal. It could be a load of crap.
Well, if going back to my startup New York example, what we found is that this Democrat policy pushed by Governor Cuomo, who progressives didn't like, if you read the articles about it, in New York newspapers, they didn't like it because they saw it as a way for the governor to enrich his friends' pockets who were building these startup New York campuses on the SUNY and CUNY campuses throughout the state. So there was a lot of pushback on it. They called it a supply side boondoggle, where his friends get wealthy. These are from the articles that we read. My wife did the research in her senior economics thesis at Westminster College.
Wow, good for her.
So we turned it into, so far it's produced 3 papers, and it's going to produce a 4th one, because there's one question we have left to answer. But what we found is its goal was to increase manufacturing, also to increase science and technology firms. And so what we found is a small positive effect that it seems to be igniting small and tiny firms on these campuses. The question we weren't able to answer back then was, is it just shifting the sand from the west side of the beach to the north side of the beach? What I mean by that is, suppose a company started in Pennsylvania, or suppose somebody started a company in a non-startup New York county. Did they just change the location of where they were making their product? Did they move it to a startup county? So in that sense, we don't know, but we are going to estimate, we're going to use a model, a spatial model, to figure out if that's happening, if they're just shifting where the GDP is being produced. Right now, we have evidence that it seems to spark company formation or relocation. If majority of it is just simply relocation, then it's not increasing the GDP of the region. And that's the problem with all these rules and regulations. If Startup New York works in startup counties, why not make the whole dang state an enterprise zone?
What is your goal? If your goal is to not have drugs made in a place that there's no proper inspection of the drug place, ban those drugs. Don't make people, like we know, pay more for them through a tariff that the government gets. I mean, what are we doing?
How well do bans work? Bans don't work very well.
Okay, but
we'll find a way around it.
I'm saying the solution is not $600 billion on our lower and middle class.
Yeah. All I'm saying is that think about the Stark New York thing. The counties that don't have a college campus.
Do you have any idea how, Carol or Harold? Do you have any idea how small that is compared to this number they're talking about in these tariffs?
Well, I know, but this is a microcosm. This is a world unto a world. We're looking at Pennsylvania.
The whole idea, all this stuff, TIF financing. Okay, we'll give you financing if you're on this block and not the next block. This all makes no sense, or does it?
Exactly. But look at what's going on in New York State. If the GDP is not being increased in the state of New York or in the New York Pennsylvania region, and simply companies are just moving their operations, or they get a tax break. What is happening to the non-startup counties? What are the non-startup counties? Non-startup counties are those rural counties that don't have a SUNY or CUNY campus. SUNY and CUNY campuses are progressive. The governor was progressive. They're hollowing out, they possibly are hollowing out rural counties in Pennsylvania and in New York State to benefit the counties that are politically aligned with the former Governor Cuomo. Now, why am I talking about this? Because this is what goes on the world stage. The people who are in power, they get to create policies that benefit themselves, D.C. and New York. So on the world stage, over the last 50 years, who has benefited from these institutions that Democrats and Republicans have put in place? People in D.C. and people in New York. Who has suffered? The people in Ohio, in rural counties in Ohio, rural counties in Idaho.
All right, so the idea there, we have lost, and I, you know, everybody rags on unions. I'm not talking about municipal unions, which I'm not big on, and I don't think you are either. But regular unions that everybody rags on, oh man, all they do is they get paid too much. You know, everybody's rags on somebody who gets paid too much. The simple fact is, not because maybe they cared or whatever, but the union lobby in Washington pretty much lined up with the middle class lobby, correct? Well, there are no unions anymore. Who exactly is the middle class lobby? Other than every stupid politician says all they do is talk about the middle class, and guess what? They haven't done anything for the middle class in 40 years. I mean, right?
No, they've all.
Yeah, they
what? The political class in D.C. has hollowed it out.
Yeah, totally hollowed it out. The question is, I mean, there were two guys who.
It was a great wealth transfer from the middle class to people on Wall Street and people and who live in D.C.
There were two guys from Indiana. Long time, if I knew the other guy's name, you'd know what I'm talking about. Was it Evan Bayh? Was the governor and he was a senator or something? I think he was on the Democrat side. And then there was a longtime Indiana dude who was a Republican. And by the way, I think they were like the best of friends. They just argued all the time like you and me. but they got on this extended radio thing, and I don't know where the hell I was going, hell, but I'm listening to it. And they both were talking about what's going on in Washington. This is probably 6-7 years ago. And you know what their conclusion was? The middle class better put their big boy pads on, get involved in politics, and get their ass back in the game.
Yeah.
Because they're not being heard anywhere because they're not demanding to be heard.
Yeah.
And both guys said that's happening. They're not heard by anybody. If you're in office, you constantly have the lobbyists there from the insurance company, from the medical company. You don't have anybody from the middle class. The veterans don't have their lobbying group is not as good as it ought to be. There's money that needs to be put in here. I mean, I'm not saying you should have to buy your government, but that seems to be the way it is. Their point was, you've let yourself get taken advantage of. And you know the funny part? When we first started the show, I don't usually get a whole lot of bad. You know, people. A lot of my points of view that I'll expose. A lot of those are just kind of for radio, in a sense that I want to drag your and Carl's point of view out because people want to listen to you, not me, all the time. So, you know, I'll act like I'm sometimes disagreeing when I'm really not, just for you to make sure you.
Well, I'm playing devil's advocate. I do.
Saying it's just so I can get all the knowledge that you have out, and if I don't jostle you, it might not happen.
Ideas have to collide.
Yeah, well, that's collide. The whole thing. I mean, that's how you learn. I mean, I learned from you. You know, if somebody believed the exact same way you did, what's the point of talking to them?
Yeah. Yeah.
And really?
You don't learn much when you live. Like, for example, I love living in downtown Salt Lake City. because all my neighbors were like Marxists, communist socialists. You wouldn't think that in downtown Salt Lake City, but
did they even know what a Marxist was?
Yeah.
Did they even know what a Marxist was, or did they just act like
when you're walking by a house and there's a big banner in front of the house that says "Down with capitalism," and nobody complains about it, and then, you know, so all my neighbors were Marxist socialists, and I love talking to them. I don't want to sit around and talk to people who think just like me. I want my ideas, I want my opinions, my ideas to collide. I want to cleanse my head of error. And the only way you get that is by talking to people who are different than you.
But what percentage, I mean, when the guys that are big capitalists, and I've had this discussion with people on the air to the point where they think I'm some, you know, pinko commie or something, which obviously if you trade 20 years in the trading floor, which is the mecca of capitalism, I mean, you can't get more capitalistic than me. However, yeah. What percentage of our economy right now would you say is competitive capitalism? I'm going to say 30%.
Yeah, I would probably put that there. I would look at things that are relatively not managed, not regulated for the most part. The only thing that really they're really doing is maybe some taxes,
license or something, or that kind of crap. Yeah,
just that, right? And I would probably put that at 30%, because what is the majority of the economy? We have universities, we have home sales, we have stocks, we have education, pharmaceutical, public education at the high school level. All that stuff is heavily regulated, managed, or owned by government. And when things are heavily managed, owned, or regulated by government, to the extent that they are, like they are today, it's neo-mercantilism. That's what it is. At neo-mercantilism, government regulations create these cartels. And the corporations that are in the cartel love it. And they lobby for things to keep...
Hell, it's like anything else. You're way better to be in the in crowd than the out crowd.
Exactly. And the unfortunate thing for me is I swim against the current on college campuses. And it gets lonely. I swim against it. I am not in the mainstream views of economics. And it gets lonely sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
I joke about it. I joke about being the only member of the Neo-Clausturian School of Economics, which is neoclassical merged with Austrian economics.
Hell, you're a Friedmanite.
I'm probably the only member of that.
You're a Friedmanite. You belong.
I'm probably the only member of that school of thought.
No, you're a Friedmanite. You belong in the University of Chicago in 1975.
When it comes to Friedman money issue, when it comes to Milton Friedman monetary policies, that's where I am pragmatic. That's where I differ from the Austrians. I think the Austrians are right. I think the Austrian business cycle theory is correct. But I'm pragmatic. The Fed is here to stay, and was the least bad way to manage the money supply. To grow M2 in some kind of metric that has been smoothed over time that produces about 1% growth in
M2. We gotta go to break, but that's not what they do anymore. Now they manage
Now they manage the wealth bubble.
Well, if they
I just updated my model on M2. We'll have to talk about it.
Yeah, I'd love to, because I mean, I know right now they're managing the wealth bubble.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no question that the big rally of the last 10 days was generated by the Fed, in my mind.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
S&P futures down 49, NASDAQ futures down 236. Be right back with a feisty Hal Snarr like he always is, and me. Hal, I learned so much from you, it's scary. Even though you think I'm just arguing with you, I'm listening, bud. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jacks. Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. As you all know, the broad markets, especially tech, have been hot for a while. Lots of reasons. New technology, small fixed income returns, a lot of Fed cash, maybe some good management. Recently, however, the rates on fixed income investments, even U.S. Treasury, have risen from the very low levels. Treasuries are more attractive. There might even be some interesting bonds out there. Also, the bull run has some leading stocks with historically high valuations, maybe making long-only positions a little riskier. So what to do? I think the answer is flexibility. The market may keep going higher, it may not, it could even go down. Is fixed income a thought for some part of the portfolio? Rates are not zero anymore. You may want to protect some gains, think about some rebalancing, address some growing concentration issues, maybe thinking about commodities. We at PTI may have a solution just right for you. Open an account at PTI Pro Direct, PTI's online trading platform using the Interactive Broker high-end platform. There you will find competitive rates and solid execution across all product lines and traditionally high interest on money balances. In addition, at any time you can seamlessly decide for fixed income investments to
to access Dan Janitas at Kratos Capital for management services. Dan and his team work tirelessly to achieve the highest returns they can, whatever risk category you are comfortable with. You can also quickly access my team for investment services and a wide array of investment strategies on the security or commodity side, protective strategies, concentration issues, or straight long. In one place, you'll be able to be flexible and ride whatever the future market holds with people you are used to hearing and trusting every day. Need help? You got it. Don't need help? That's okay, too. You'll have a great self-management platform with help always available. This market can change on a dime. I believe, like everyone else, having the right people there if needed is the way to go. Call me at 312-663-4310 or email me at time@ptisecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howe. Ricky on the board. SP Futures now down 51. We're leaking a little more. NASDAQ Futures down 245. Dow Futures down 275. We have the, let's go around the rest of the world here real quick. Over in Europe, DAX down 159.7%. FTSE down 4. Call that flat. CAC around down 25.3%. 77.02. Over in Asia, we've got the Nikkei. They did not trade. Last trade was 5-2. So they're not trading. Hang Seng has reopened. They're up 158. And these guys have been closed for like 3-4 days, so they're catching up. They're up 158.7%. In mainland China, which has been was closed since like last April, is up 37.1%. I'm not sure. Russell will know tomorrow why these guys were closed. 10-year unchanged 4.34. The Bund up 1 basis point, 2.53. Oil went up $1.56, 58.69 after they kind of landed at 55.50. Tuesday, yesterday morning. Ran up $1.55, 61.78. Well, interesting to see if that 55.50 print is the low here or not. Natural gas down 5 cents, 3.50. Gold rallied again today. It was a big rally yesterday, up $61 today. It's almost 2%, 33.84. Silver up 81 cents, 33.29. Foreign exchange, we've got the dollar is under a little bit of pressure as the pound is up 0.002, but it's 113.4. It's kind of near the high. I'm on the euro. The British pound is up 0.009, so we're almost at 134. So that's kind of getting up there as well. Crypto, Bitcoin down 596, but still pretty high, 93,937. Ricky, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Morning, Chief. 6:37 a.m. here in beautiful Chicago. 51 degrees right now with a high of 71. Warm and mostly cloudy morning today. We're going to see some sun in the afternoon. Tonight will be partly cloudy with a low of 55 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 61 degrees right now with a high of 74. Shower this morning, times of clouds and sun this afternoon, and we might have a couple of showers late tonight with a low of 60 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, Iman Kennedy from Monroe's. We actually don't have any information on Iman Kennedy from Monroe's. That was my bad. Iman Edens from Lane Cook, we have 33 minutes. Iman Eisenhower from Wolf, 56 minutes, 33 minutes. Iman Den Ryan from 95th. Iman Stevenson from 294 to the Den Ryan, 50 minutes. MLB, yesterday the White Sox lose to the Royals 3-0. Cubs beat Giants 9-2 and Diamondbacks lose to the Mets 4-5. We got back-to-back games today. White Sox at Royals 6:40 p.m. Giants at Cubs 6:40 p.m. and Mets at Diamondbacks 8:40 p.m. For the NBA, Knicks beat Celtics yesterday 108-105. Nuggets beat Thunder 121-119. And today we got Pacers at Cavaliers 6 p.m. and Warriors at Timberwolves at 8:30 p.m. Lastly, NHL, yesterday Maple Leafs beat the Panthers 5-4 and Hurricanes beat Capitals today at 6 p.m. and Oilers at Golden Knights 8:30 p.m. Back over to you guys, Chief.
So Hal, What do you suppose? I guess to ask you, I was going to ask you, who's really running the Fed? But I'm not so sure any of us know that. This number that we're back to, this money supply growth, this 5.1, 5.2, has sort of been the number we always kind of returned to really since 2000. After 2007, it kicked up to, you know, to 8% or something there for a while after that fiasco, after the 2007 thing where we really goosed some money into the system. But by and large, going back to 2000, it's been this 5.1, 5.2 I won't say every year, but it seems like it's the number that somebody put out there, whoever the somebody is, whether there's a second coming of Christ or something, I don't know. But somehow or another, now we're right back to it. We were there... before the COVID stuff, and now we're right back to it again. Who has decided that this is the number when the growth is probably like 2? Every year we're going to get this 3-4% inflation, and every year we do, and then we say it's 2. Or where am I wrong here?
Yeah, I don't know where it's coming from, but I just updated my projected M2 and with a 90% R-square. I date this trend back to about July of 2023, and it's quadratic, meaning it's after it bottomed out last spring or the beginning of
quadratic.
Quadratic. It's not linear. It was dropping, right? Initially during the initial part of the trend, it decreases at a decreasing rate. Then it bottoms out, and about the end of 2023, and it starts growing at an increasing rate.
You do know there was a time.
So
when
it's
I knew
it's a parabola. It's a parabola.
You do know there was a time when
the R square is about 90%.
There was a time I knew when you were talking what you were talking about. I took a course in quadratic programming and network flows, but that was like how many years ago?
So yeah, this is just a quadratic trend.
You know, it's interesting. Explain to people what quadratic means. It's
a quadratic trend. Like for example, when we came out of COVID, the money supply actually fell. But if you look at the money supply while it was falling during that period of time where it was falling, and you compare it to where it was before COVID, it was about 40% that you talk about, right?
Yeah.
We had this 40% increase in M2. So you had this huge injection of money. If they would have kept injecting that money, if we would have stayed on that, we would have probably had a hyperinflation. So they had to back it off. And they started backing it off near the end of 2021. That's when they started backing off M2 growth. And it fell. It fell at this quadratic rate, which means it's... Remember in high school when you graphed x squared?
Oh, yeah.
It was a parabola.
Yep.
It fell, then it bottomed out, then it rose, and it's symmetric at the bottom of that graph. Well, that's the kind of growth pattern we see in M2 right now. And if you go back to about, if you start the series about July of 2023, it is the correlation is unbelievable. The data points are really close to this quadratic trend. And the Fed does nothing to change it. If it continues on this
trend. They're not changing it. They're the ones that are doing it.
If they stay on this trend, if we stay on this trend for a year, M2 is going to increase by 11%. If we stay on this trend. And they've been on this trend that I've been watching since July of 2023.
Okay, whoa. You got to back up on me here. Why are you seeing 11 and I'm seeing 5?
Because I'm projecting this trend into a year from now.
Okay.
Yeah. According to this trend, right now, it's 5 to 6%, according to the trend, 5. From a
6?
Year ago.
Okay.
About 5 to 6. About 5 to 6.
Yeah, that's about right. I've got the last 3 months at 5.1, which seems...
But this trend has been going on since July of 2023. And you can't really differentiate between this trend, when I map out this trend with the data points, the M2 data points behind it, you can't really see a difference. There's some ups. Sometimes it's above the trend, sometimes it's below the trend, but most of the time it's right on trend.
We're actually above right now the high point in the COVID as of last month. You know, I got a question for you. When you mentioned if they continued to put the, you know, the 40% a year number that they were doing during COVID, I noticed something odd in there. But again, I don't have the mathematical tools that you do. If you were to been in the monetarist classes in the University of Chicago, and I was, and somebody would have said, young Hal, how long does it take if somebody increases the money supply from, you know, 3% to 3.5% or decrease from 3 to 2.5%, how long does that take to work its way through the system? The knee-jerk number was 5 to 7 months. It was like, or maybe a little more than 6 months, something like that would be the knee-jerk number.
Yeah.
Now, when somebody, you mentioned if they would have stayed doing the 40%, I'm asking you, this is what I sense, but I don't have the, like I said, the empirical tools. I think when you put that much money in that fast, I don't think the place can even absorb it to the point where...
Well, you consider how money is you compare the technology of today to the technology of the 70s, where you had to literally call a banker.
Yeah.
You had to, like, maybe go into the bank, right? Go into the, you had to go to the window, right? Nowadays, a lot of it's just electronic.
Well, my point
the
is
technology makes it quicker.
My point is, I think that the if you put 40% in, I think the number's not 6 months anymore. It might be like two or 3 years. Because the reason why I say that is before they all started working from home, which is the most ridiculous thing, my buddies at the Fed, who used to have an adult beverage with one night a week, they told me, I didn't even know what M0 was, did you?
Yeah.
You did know that? You know more than me then.
Well, it's been a while since I taught him money and banking, but isn't M0 just the money that is in, most part, that's in the reserve system? All those reserves,
it's pretty much M0, right? It's the money that banks kick back to Fed at night.
Yeah, okay.
Well, they put...
In the repo market.
Yeah, here's my question. They put so much money into the system during the COVID that the banks essentially they kicked it back to the Fed at night. So even though they were increasing the money supply by 40%, they couldn't increase it fast enough. It couldn't be absorbed that fast. So
if the Fed wasn't given the tool interest on reserves, and there's an equivalent interest on reserves rate in the repo market, they're set at about the same rate. The way you calculate is you take the price that you buy these repos. Like when you're going to buy a repo, it's like a temporary renting of this money.
The repo means there's a price, but then you got to give it back to them. Say
the next day, right?
Yeah.
And that ratio, and then you subtract one from that, you can annualize that. And it really is, they have this similar kind of rate in the repo market that is almost identical in terms of numerical value to the interest on reserves rate. And they keep those two things together.
Well, there's so much money kicked back to the Fed that M0 was bigger than M1, which I can't. Can you even imagine that? M1 is all cash in circulation and all demand deposits of everybody in the country. The money getting kicked back to the Fed at night was more than all the cash in circulation and demand deposits of everybody. Can you even think of that?
Yeah. Well, think what would have been the situation had the Fed not capped, because these two rates that we're talking about, the repo rate and the interest on reserves rate, they are price caps.
Yeah.
They're intended to keep the money in the banking system.
Well, not really, because it's out of the banks can't even absorb it. That's what the Fed funds rate is there even a Fed funds market anymore?
Well, there is, because what banks do is when they get reserves, they keep it in the banking system because the Fed is paying them interest.
All right, we got to back up a hair here. Yeah. Because I think we're way over the top.
Yeah.
When the Fed raises the Fed funds rate, the Fed's in charge of the amount of money that's essentially in the pool, right?
It doesn't do it the way it used to do it, where it used to do an open market purchase.
Well, what I'm saying is they're in charge of they're in charge of the money in the pool. So the Fed funds rate is the rate at which a bank, if a guy like Hal has got, $100 million, yanks it out of one bank and puts it in another bank. One bank may not have enough reserves that night because Hal just dragged his $100 million out of there. But now the bank that he put it into now has an excess of reserves. So the federal funds rate is the rate at which one bank charges another overnight to even up the amount of reserves because they can borrow it back and forth among themselves.
Yeah.
So when the Fed manages the amount of money in the pool, so if they take money out of the pool by essentially selling bonds, correct? Or selling the government paper they have in inventory. Now, if Bank A that Hal took the money out of calls up Bank B and says, "Hey Joe, I need $50 million," and the guy says, "Well, last night it was 3%. Tonight it's 3.001," because now all of a sudden there's a little. It's a competitive market, and what the Fed does is manages the depth of the pool so they can bring that money that amount up and down. So what they're really talking about is when they say they're lowering interest rates, they're saying they're going to put enough money in the pool so that within a week or two, when that phone call is made, the number is what they're shooting for, correct?
Well, but that changed in 2008.
Right. Well, then, but
in 2008, they instituted interest on reserves because the Fed was going to buy all these mortgage-backed securities that they bought 600 billion of them, right?
Yeah, they
released in about a month.
Yeah, they essentially. I know two guys that retired from the federal funds market because the interest rates were so low. Some guy worked. He did a lot of work with Northern Trust because they always had excess reserves. He told me this is over a beer. He get a load of this, Al. He goes, last night they borrowed $100 million, and the interest didn't cover the wire transfer fee.
Yeah.
I mean, what the hell was that all about? There was so much money sloshing around. What was money for nothing and your chicks for free?
In 2008, the Fed got the tool interest on reserves.
They didn't really
and
use it.
And what that
though.
Did is it put a floor on interest rates.
But it didn't happen until COVID, though, right?
Now is when the Fed buys a lot of treasuries from banks.
Okay.
When it buys it, in the past, that would lower interest rates.
Right.
But that doesn't happen anymore because it's got this floor. So now when the Fed wants to lower or raise interest rates, because there's so many reserves in the banking system, right? There's this explosion of reserves in the banking system just after 2008. It exploded not once, not twice, not three. It exploded three times. And then it kind of exploded a few years later.
Well, it blew up during COVID,
right? So now what the
right?
Fed does.
Yeah.
Yeah, now with the, yeah, during COVID. Now what the Fed does, it just simply says, we're going to pay, instead of paying 3%, we're going to pay 3.5%. It doesn't have to do an open market purchase or a sale to change interest rates. All it has to do is say, we're going to change the interest rate we were paying on these reserves. And this principle applies to the repo market.
Yeah, but they still have to
they
get
the
money.
Same thing, repo market.
They still got to get money in and out of the system, which they're still participating in the open market.
Yeah.
Anyway,
but what we have now is the Fed just saying that we're going to pay X percent as of today, and that changes how much reserves are in the banking system.
Okay, but now we're back to they're putting more in. What I don't want to have, and I'm I can't even get people to agree with me. The last thing I want hitting the lower to middle class is inflation plus tariff taxes. Could you possibly eviscerate them anymore?
Yeah. Well, I think the goal, if you look at what President Trump wants to do with taxes, he wants to. He's been floating the idea of eliminating taxes on incomes below, I think, $100,000 or something like that. What he wants to do is he wants to shift the income tax burden from income taxes on the middle class and lower to like tariffs. And I don't think he can raise enough money with tariffs. And I don't think he can eliminate the income taxes that people pay. He's been floating this idea of no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, no tax on Social Security.
Yeah, but here's the rub that I can't seem to get across at all, it appears. You raise taxes on one and you come up with a bunch of BS ideas of what you might do somewhere else. The fact is they're up. Right?
Well, I think what we need to do is we need to have a complete revamping of
taxes. I'm saying what the man has done, how many times do I have to say this? The man has done is instituted a tax with all kinds of ideas swirling about maybe benefiting some other lower tax down the way. None of that's happened yet. All I know is today my tax went up. Right now, that's all we know. Is it? Isn't it?
Well, you know, to take the...
Boy, if you're a Trump supporter, I cannot get this through any Trump supporter.
Yeah, well, I'll take the position of Democrats, what they usually say, right? These corporations, they need to pay higher taxes, like Amazon, AT&T, Verizon. They all need to pay higher taxes, right? Because they gotta pay a fair share. Now, if our tariffs are say 2%, we're only taxing these wealthy European companies 2%.
We're not taxing them at all. We're taxing ourselves.
Well,
how are you taxing them? We pay it.
When you charge a tax, the burden is shared between the buyer and the seller. It doesn't matter who you tax. When you tax corporations, like a cigarette company is okay with the tax. Why? Because people are addicted to cigarettes, and the consumer pays a majority of that tax. Whether you're taxing the firm or you're taxing the consumer, it doesn't matter who you tax. Because what determines who pays the burden of the tax is who's sensitive to a price increase. If you're addicted to something, you're going to be insensitive to a price increase. So what the tax does is that, one, it eliminates cigarette manufacturers, the marginal cigarette manufacturers, leaving maybe just one or two left in the market. And the price they receive net of the tax drops very little. Whereas the after-tax price that a cigarette smoker is going to pay is much higher because they're addicted to the cigarettes. So who pays the tax? Who you charge the tax to makes no difference. Who bears the burden of the tax is who's more sensitive to an increase in price. And if the firms have very, so the whole idea comes back to this idea of elasticity. So you have to understand the elasticity, right? If the tax is put on these products coming in from Europe or China, those companies don't pay 100%, the consumer doesn't pay 100% of the tax, right? If the consumer has lots of choices, they're going to pay a very small increase in the price because maybe they can get it domestically, maybe they can get it from a vintage store, a used store. If they have lots of choices, they can choose not to buy another company.
Hell, it's not. Let's keep it simple.
Yeah.
There's three variables. Again, one of my college papers, I talk about this all the time, one of my college papers was on this is in a three variable world, it's very simple. We put a 20% tax on Mercedes's. Mercedes's are $50,000. The Cadillac, the competing Cadillac, is $40,000. All right, so yeah. when the Mercedes hits the thing here, somebody sends a $10,000 check, the importer, to Trump, to the U.S. government. That's for sure, right?
Yeah.
Now,
well, a person buying a Mercedes. A person buying a Mercedes is different than a person buying a banana.
No, it isn't.
Want the Mercedes.
Can I follow through on this?
But their demand. But Tom, a person buying Mercedes is going to buy a Mercedes whether it's 10% cheaper or 10% more expensive.
No, they're not. Like you just said, everything is elastic. The Mercedes is coming in at $50,000. Everybody's convinced that it's worth $10,000 more than a Cadillac because that's how the Cadillac is priced, right? So if you buy a Mercedes, you think it's worth $10,000 more than a Cadillac, or whatever reason you buy it. Maybe you're buying it because the seat fits better. Who the hell knows? But bottom line is, it gets here, somebody sends a $10,000 check to the government. This is the hard fact, Hal. And now the Mercedes should be $60,000.
But a Mercedes is not eggs. Mercedes is a luxury item. And people that buy luxury items generally are less sensitive to price change.
Can I just go through the simplest example here?
Okay.
So now Mercedes may say, wait a minute, we're going to eat part of that, which is what you just said, by the way. They may say, okay, we're going to lower our Mercedes from 50 to 47, which lowers the tax from 10 down to 9,400. Okay, so now we get a little something on that side. Mercedes might eat some of this. Okay, so now Cadillac says, all right, now the Mercedes, even though those guys ate some of it, is now, it's not $60,000, but it's 56. Okay, because they lowered some of the tariffs a little bit. You know what we can do? We can raise the price of our Cadillac now to 43 because now our competitor is higher. So we know the 10,000 goes to the government, okay, or 9,400 now goes to the government. That part's secure. The government got their tax, but it's somebody's paying it. Now Mercedes is going to pay some of it. The guy who buys the Mercedes is going to pay a lot of it, and the guy now who the Cadillac price is going up, it's now going to affect the Cadillac buyer as well because he's got to pay more. That absolutely, and you are correct. It would take somebody like you to say, how much is Mercedes going to eat? How much is Cadillac going to go up? I doubt very seriously if Cadillac is going to stay steady. Oh, man, we're so philanthropic, we're not going to raise our price. I think that's wrong. They're going to. Because, by the way, if it works, there's going to be a higher demand for Cadillacs, right? So the Cadillac price is going to go up. So the consumer, you and me, whether it's a luxury item or another item, we're now saddled with increased costs of the domestic manufacturer. You know, by the way, the $10,000 is coming out of somebody's pocket, and some of it's coming out of mine. You can't.
So here's, yeah.
It's never going to get to the point where it's never going to get to the point where Mercedes says we're going to eat the whole thing and drop the price of the car down to $41,000. Yeah. I don't think that's ever happened. Yeah,
the demand for the Cadillac is going to go up. The demand for the Mercedes is going to go down. Where is the Cadillac being produced? Probably in the United States.
But as a consumer, the price.
If the Cadillac's being produced in Mexico or Canada, you're not going to see that effect. But if it's being produced in the United States, then the demand for the Cadillac is going to go up.
And so,
because the demand for the Cadillac has gone up, the price gets pushed up the supply curve. That is true, right? But in order to produce those new Cadillacs, you have to do what? You have to hire more workers, right? You have to expand your production to handle that higher demand.
I want to be in the government spot. I want my 10 grand first and let the rest of it play out to the rest of the schmucks. And I'm tired of being the schmuck.
Yeah. Well, all I'm saying is the consumer, if the good is a want, generally, if it's a luxury good and your income is high, you're insensitive to price change. You're going to pay most of the tariff. However, if you have choices, if you can buy the banana from Brazil, Haiti, or Indonesia, and one of those countries isn't tariffed.
Yeah, but we just put a 10% tariff on everybody. So how does that argument work?
What I'm saying, though, is you can buy the banana or you can buy a different fruit, right? When it comes to food, you can shift your preferences. You can buy meat. You can buy chicken, right? So when you have choices domestically or internationally, when products being made by multiple countries, consumers in America have choices.
So your bottom
line, and when they have choices,
we got to dash it. Is your conclusion that if somehow or another our government gets their $600 billion. You're saying that if you're clever, you're not affected by that at all? I cannot.
Well, they're not
going
to get the $600 billion. They're going to get $600 billion, Thomas. The quantity of goods imported into the United States is going to shrink. So it's not going to be $600 billion. It might be $400 billion.
Say it's $500 billion.
Because the Q part shrinks.
I understand it. Say it's $500 billion. Yeah. Are you saying that if you're clever, the end of the year, not one dime of that came out of your pocket? You can't be saying that.
No, I'm not saying that. No.
Okay, what so I'm saying it's a tax increase.
If tariffs go up on two different kinds of goods, let's take two different goods. One is a need, and one is a want. And the need is produced by people domestically and internationally, and there's a lot of competition. The want is produced by one nation. What I'm saying is, demand for those goods will shift. The demand for the imports of these goods will shift. They'll decrease.
I'm with you. I'm saying
but
is the
for the want or the luxury good, the consumer is going to bear most of the burden of that tariff.
We got a dash here, but the conclusion you may not be doing it on purpose. The conclusion you're bringing to the table is, if you're clever enough and you don't go for the high price crap, the end of the day, none of the $500 billion is coming out of your pocket. I'm saying I don't agree with that at all.
No, I'm not saying none. I'm just saying if there's lots of suppliers of a particular good, or there's close substitutes, and some of those substitutes are made domestically, then the consumer of those goods is going to pay a much smaller burden of the tariff than the producer.
But it's still a burden. My point is, it is still a tax increase. It's still supposed to come from Congress. This is my only point.
But a 45% tariff placed on a good that has lots of substitutes, close substitutes, the tariff isn't going to be a one-for-one. It's not going to be a 45% increase in the price.
No, it's not. I agree with you. We're agreed on that, but it's not going
to be
zero. It might
be 10%. It might be 5%. It might be 20%.
Right? Well, whatever. But all right, SP Futures down 45. NASDAQ Futures down 225. Hey, good stuff as usual. Where are you? You're in you're Carolina. You're traveling
around. I'm grading this week. We got grades due on Monday.
So you're home?
We got graduation Saturday. Yeah, I'm at home right now, yeah.
Does the mobile home still run or what?
We got it parked up on our – we bought a little piece of property in Virginia, and we're going to try to go visit it this summer.
If you turned it on, would it move?
Oh, it would, yeah. But gas is too expensive for me to drive it around, so I park it.
What do you mean? Oil's under $60 a gallon.
Well, where I park it, well, when you're getting 8 miles a gallon and you got six kids to feed, or four kids to feed, a family of six, that trip gets pretty expensive. So,
are you gas or diesel in that thing?
Gas.
Are the diesels better for in terms of mileage?
Well, I think in a big rig, yeah, definitely, yeah. But in terms of price per gallon, gas is better. So I think in the end, it kind of washes probably.
Why don't you just, you know, get down the weather thing and be going, only go when you're with the wind or downhill?
Well, hey, we got it parked on a piece of land that we own, and if we had it parked at a rental, at one of those outdoor RV parking lots that you have to pay money for, the HOA is the same money as the parking it at a at a.
This place have they have the pool rental. And this place have the pool and all that stuff too.
Oh, it's got three pools. Oh, cool. It's got it's got three pools. It's got fishing, lots of little lakes, hiking. The kids can roast marshmallows. It's basically in the woods.
Oh, it's nice. Good for you.
It's really nice.
Are you a big fisher dude or no?
I'm a kind of guy that will drink a Busch Light, hook a worm, and throw it in the water and fall asleep.
And hope nobody bites it. I don't even want to do the worm. I'll do the artificial thing and hope nobody bites.
When I wake up, I got to reel it in because that fish has taken my hook about 300 yards.
God. Take care of yourself, bud. Good stuff. SP Futures down 47. NASDAQ Futures down 226. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.